everybody. This is Robin Ayu from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Today we are recording episode 166 or 65, I think. I lost count now. I've been doing these recordings on a more frequent basis than I did in the past. So that's, if I missed a count, guys, don't worry about it. You can correct me in the comments. I love to hear from you anyway on a good news or a bad news. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Thanks for being part of this conversation. I really appreciate it. Taking a listen to our conversations together. Today, my guest of honor is MJ Jang, and MJ joins me from Michigan from a company called Credibly. And today, we are going to be talking about various topics when it comes to AI and AI conversation in general, plus strategy. We'll focus on a few things. And why do people don't realize the benefit from their AI applications? Excuse me, one second. From their AI applications. And we're going to try to dive into all of this. Before we get started on this channel, MJ, we say everybody's got a story. So let's start with the easy one. What's your story? What got you here?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on the show, Robin. I'm super happy to be here. So as you know, I currently work as the Chief Strategy Officer at Credibly, but just a few years ago, I was actually in automotive. So I did my stint with Ford Motor Company, where I launched a lot of vehicles, learned a lot about how to run a business and how to bring things into standardization. I worked in corporate strategy there as well. And then before that, I was really just in business school, right? I was a career shifter. So I went into marketing and operations. My first job out of college was actually in human rights in DC. So I learned much more about critical thinking and how to be empathetic with others who maybe don't share some of the life that I've lived. And as an undergrad, I was a lit major. So that sort of continued my liberal arts education. I grew up in New York City, just going backwards. And originally, I'm from China. I was born in Shanghai, which is one of the largest cities in the world. So yeah, that's how I ended up in Michigan. But currently, I am leading AI innovation at Credibly. I run the innovation team here. I also run all of marketing and sales, and I'm responsible for the growth of the company from an originations perspective.
Absolutely. Now, you're a Harvard graduate, right? So at least that's what I see on your profile. Is correct. That correct? Yeah.
That is correct.
So, yeah. And for the audience, just to elaborate on and MJ is being humbled with her intro. So let me do a little bit more elaborate one. She's a senior leader working at the intersection of Gen AI, business modeling, transformation, and organizational execution. MJ works focuses on something most companies struggle with, turning AI into AI strategy into a real operational change without breaking teams, culture, or trust. And what stood out to me personally, I was reading some of your content online, her leadership philosophy. She measures success not just by outcome, by whether the people around her leaves stronger, more confident, and more capable than when they arrive. I guess this conversation today will be focusing on leadership under AI pressure, building high-performance teams in period of change. I guess we're all going through that right now. And what actually works when Gen AI moves from slide deck into an operating model. Hopefully that resonates a little bit with the audience. To get started here, MJ, if you don't mind, let's get with this one. You're leading Gen AI business model, as you mentioned earlier, transformation right now. What problem were you actually hired to solve?
That's a great question. So one of the things that we want to do in our industry, we're a lending industry, right? So we make loans to small businesses. And speed and customer experience are key in this industry. And so every lender is competing on how do I get faster and how do I get more accurate, which has to do with the risks associated with underwriting. So the problem, so our North Star for our company has always been fastest submission to fund. So you get an application to us, how do we get money into your bank account as fast as possible? And this requires a lot of underwriting steps that are manual and complex to undergo automation and to make sure that ultimately the business that's receiving our money goes through that without roadblocks and has a really good experience that's built on trust and fostered by technology. So that was our mantra for many years. And when I was leading, and I'm still leading the Skunkworks team here, which was followed and modeled after Lockheed Martin in their Skunkworks from World War II, one of the things that we talked about is keeping this as what we always thinking about having that customer mindset, but making sure we're using the latest technologies and addressing some of the most difficult problems in the company, like problems that the industry had no solutions for. And this is where that innovation and generative AI really came in a few years ago to help us get to where we are today.
Now, when we talk about evaluating data for the purpose of lending, I'm assuming there's a lot of reasoning that takes place using AI. This is not just database indexing and vectoring. This is a little bit more sophisticated than that to assess the loan and the individual applying for the loan, where does it fit? Does it fit to begin with, et cetera? There's a lot of variables that goes into the evaluation, specifically on the logic, reasoning, and doing, you know, assisting in the decisioning of this particular loan. How did you solve that?
Yeah, this is a great question because I think it gets into the heart of like, where should you even use generative AI, right? Because there's a lot of reports out there in the real world about potential issues with bias and discrimination, which we know is problematic, especially in the credit space. And so one of the things that I think is very clear that we've decided upfront is that there is no decisioning being made by generative AI. That is purely something that we have to really look at humans to be able to do, because we want to make sure that these black box tools at scale don't drift slowly over time. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't use generative AI to assist in helping make that decision, but it is not making final determinations or sign off. So the initial package that we had to think through when the models were a little bit older, this was with ChatGPT 3.5, even GPT-4, Claude 3.5, all of which have been updated now, was using it for data extraction, right? The ability to extract the data in a structured way from third-party sources, from websites, and being able to package it in a way that's really clear for the underwriter so that they can go through it without having to go spend time, look for that information themselves. So that Gen AI was really used for data extraction, data structuring, and data summarization, which is, I think a lot of companies are using that, right? But it's one thing to do it for an email. It's another thing to do it at scale via APIs in an enterprise in a way that is very structured, that then also allows people to monitor through models. So that was probably the first phase, which was really using the frontier models at that time, which were not yet sort of the super highly reasoning models, and being able to accomplish those tasks. Even then, we ran into issues with like computer vision. So one great example is being able to extract information from tax returns and being able to surface that up to understand the health of a business. So back then, you didn't have enough capabilities in these models where it would do that accurately. The lines would be off. It would be reading one line, but giving you answers to another line. So we had to create these boundary boxes around these PDFs. With the next generation of models, that issue went away instantly. And so as you're learning to work with Gen AI, keeping up with what the frontier models are able to do is really important. So many companies I know are locked into Microsoft Copilot as their sanctioned version of working with generative AI, but that's just not where the models are today, right? If you're not experimenting and working with Claude 4.5 and GPT 5.1 and Gemini 3 Pro, like you have to work. One of my mandates for my team is you have to work across at least two frontier models. So you understand where the capabilities are and that you're able to take problems from one, put it into another, and kind of figure out where the lines are. So that's the problems we were solving for in the beginning were extraction and data structure issues, which continue today, but they're less now. The problems we're coming up now, right, is like in terms of integrating data at scale is like, okay, we can use it to answer certain questions. So we have a series of steps and a series of questions that then has a reasoning approach, which is like, for example, for this industry, does the web presence make sense for this industry? That is a very subjective question. Does it make sense? If you're a restaurant, you should probably have some social media presence. You should probably have a website, right? But if you're like a one-man contractor, maybe you don't have that. And so it starts to be very different for industries. And that's when using generative AI can help you reason through some of these steps, but you still need to teach it how humans think about this problem and using experience to guide it. One of the things that I did when I do training in Credibly is generative AI does not have a mental model, and a lot of people don't understand that. So knowing that it does not have a mental model will help you figure out where to use it and also where not to use it.
So are you referring to some technologists or some users in general are treating AI like a human and we should not elevate it to that level?
Correct. I think that there's a tendency to anthropomorphize because it is so human-like in its answers. And I'll give you some great examples. And I've taken a couple courses at Wharton, which I think gives really credence to this example. There's a theory called the jagged edge, right, of performance, which is basically you can teach a model to do one thing really well, but the thing next to it, the adjacent thing next to it that you also think it should be able to do very well, it does not do very well. So there are great examples, as people already know, of generative AI's inability to create images of people who are left-handed because it's not in its training data, even though in the real world, there's many more left-handed people than you would encounter. My daughter.
I tried that with right? me. I'm a left-handed.
Yeah, it's very hard. Even the latest models have a really hard time doing that. If you put in a math equation that is converting from Fahrenheit to Celsius, it will get that math equation right. However, if you put in a temperature that is not Earth's temperature, that is like 570 degrees, it will start to get it wrong. And if you change just one number in the denominator of that fraction, it will start to get it wrong because it's not in the training data. This is not an issue that exists with humans who have a mental model because you can actually generalize. If I teach you how to do three-digit multiplication, you also know how to do two-digit multiplication because it's along the same way about how your brain functions. You can actually generalize in a way that makes sense. But generative AI will fail at certain tasks, even though they're very similar. And I've seen a lot of chats where like these students just like people think, and I when I run with my Gen AI champion group here, I get that same feedback when people are not used to working with it. They're like, I feel like if I just keep asking it the question and self, like it should be able to get it. And I'm like, if you're a person, right, you can kind of tell when someone's on the verge of getting an answer and you can kind of push them. You can nudge them to do it, but you can't really do that with a predictive model that doesn't have its own mental model. So there's like people get very frustrated with like, I feel like if I just ask it the right way, it's going to give me an answer, not realizing that it doesn't have a mental model. Another thing that happens, which I think we've all seen in terms of hallucinations and variability, is that it's not that Gen AI is not as accurate as humans. A lot of times it's more accurate. And it's more consistently accurate. However, the issue is in the times where it's wrong, it's unpredictably wrong in a way that humans would never be wrong. So for example, when you ask it to analyze things like someone in my class said it was asking it to look at their own bank statements, right? So they're looking at transactions to figure out like, help me understand what I spend my money on. And so it came up with this like chart that was like, you spend 10% of your money at Trader Joe's. And this guy's like, I have never been to Trader Joe's. I have not gone there a single time. Humans can make the error of like, maybe it wasn't 10%, maybe it was 15%, but you would never invent a transaction that didn't occur. There. So this really, I think, throws people for a loop where they see the errors. It's not, again, that's, and we'll get into metrics and ROI. And this is where you start, things start to get really interesting because it can be right and consistent in really good ways. But when it's wrong in a way that humans can't understand. And that's where it creates additional liability. And that's where it creates errors and which you can't de-risk for because you don't understand how they would have occurred in the first place. So these are things I find to be very interesting and like actually working with generative AI.
MJ, the general understanding at this stage is we're still going through a training phase, if you will call it, or I want to call it training phase, but trust phase more than anything else, because we are training the AI data gathering. We are the living lab of everything that we do out there. The more we interact with it, the more it's learning from us, I'm assuming. And I'm seeing improvement like on a daily basis. Like, the models are being updated regularly. Like every day I open my GPT and I feel like there's a new things coming up. It's better. It's handling better the information. I see that fractional improvement on a day-to-day basis. Are you seeing that, A, and B, how long do you think that whole trust phase will last between us not trusting those big problems that you just stated? For instance, that's not a good indicator of if you have a kid and they're making those huge mistakes, but they're making good grades in school, you probably have some concern. And somebody explained to me that we are right now with AI, with the relationship, it's like having a teenager at home where you're trying to school and teach and bring them on the right track, etc. What's your comments?
Yeah. So I think the trust question will continue to persist. Now, the models are certainly getting more advanced, right? Claude for Excel was just launched and it, like these models like did not know how to work with spreadsheets. And now I think someone in our finance department uploaded like 500 files and it did an analysis perfectly. So it's also the tech labs now learning how to work with real businesses and what is actually required in businesses. When you just a couple years ago, everything was done in code. It's like people didn't know that like businesses needed Excel and PowerPoint. And that's like literally what most businesses do is Excel and PowerPoint. They run their entire business out of that. And so the tech labs are starting to catch up in terms of like, how do we actually get more practical in what's being used? However, I still think in terms of the black box, there's very few people in the world who can actually build LLMs. In fact, like a lot of people, even the ones who are the product managers, they don't know how it works, right? They just tell you these things are more capable, but they don't actually understand it, which is an interesting phenomenon. So the trust factor, I think, to back to your question, I think trust is easier when it touches on purely rational and cognitive efforts. And so, for example, you're using it to complete a task. It's giving you an accurate assessment. You're pretty happy with it, right? Trust becomes much more problematic when it starts to touch core pieces of identity that the person is using it for or potentially not using it for. So that's where like you see a lot of pushback from the creative industries. Writing, film, production, right? Like actors, where they're just kind of saying like, hey, this is my work. This is my life's work, my voice, my look, my skills. And now these things are part of the internet in image data and in film data. And now it's being used by this tool to create things that's taking advantage of my originality and what I own. And that's a problem for me. And I think as a creative writer or as a musician or as an artist, this becomes much more problematic because it's touching on a piece of you that you have invested years in where your process and the quality of output has been tightly coupled for millenniums. And now it's being broken apart in a very disruptive way. And I think that's really hard for people to come to terms with it. Trust is also problematic when you're talking about younger people and people who don't have as much experience and who are not really born technologists, who then are using it in a way to de-skill and to do cognitive offloading. And I wrote about this in a way that doesn't actually make them better, right? So it makes their product better, but it doesn't make them better. And if the skills that you want to cultivate, you want to be truly good at them, but you work on in a way where you can't really get better, and all you're doing is just being lazy, then I think that is also a problem with trust. I have my husband, who is a senior developer, has had to review code from junior developers who use AI to write the code. Now, these tools have the entire experience of the internet, so it writes really sophisticated code. But the junior developers don't understand it. They just know that it works when it passes certain tests, but they don't understand the why. And once people stop asking the why, and you can't really ask the why with generative AI, that starts to be problematic. So we also have a lot of articles now talking about senior developers who are feeling the sort of the burning out at their companies pushing them to use AI to increase their workload and be more efficient. But what they're actually doing is they're reviewing code that's written by generative AI, but the code is like so much longer and more sophisticated. And so they have to spend more time making sure it's accurate, but also not being able to know why someone else gave them that code. So you take the efficiencies, you increase the work that's being produced from junior developers, but what you're actually doing is also at the expense of people who have expertise. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on in this space that I think where trust will continue to be part of the conversation for quite a while.
Is there a feedback loop mechanism between the cognitive input by a human to an output from an AI and back to AI? Sort of like I work in the localization industry and AI is really all over translation and the language industry. And we see the same thing that the coders are seeing. We see the same thing as developers and everybody else is seeing. You know, the translators are reviewing, for instance, language output from AI, and they're faced with the same dilemma. You know, the cognitive value that they bring, the thinking and the expertise and the professionalism they bring into the input to correct this stuff. In a lot of cases, the translators are saying, hey, I'm rewriting the whole thing because it missed a context or that's not what this is supposed to be about, etc. But what's missing is, and I think in the developers' space or the software development space, same idea, is when we correct something, we're not going back to AI and saying, here's the corrected version for the next time. I think we still have that gap. I'm not sure if there's a systematic way of doing this, but I'm sure also there is possible that there are some people are doing it individually on an individual basis, but there is no systematic way of giving that feedback to the models so the models can learn from its mistakes. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that it will come, but I think it's very difficult, right? Because there's a few things. One, these models are built on massive data sets. So the training data is incredibly massive. And so your feedback to it doesn't really matter because it's like a drop in the universe, you know, like it's not going to.
Even on the personalization point of view, MJ, even if you personalize.
If you have a localized model with guardrails that you fine-tuned, obviously that will work better, but that's a lot of resources. Not all companies have the resources to download and fine-tune a model and put guardrails in a way. And then also there's a question of like, if you put too many guardrails on Gen AI, then it doesn't work as well, right? Because it's supposed to be creative. It's not supposed to be super rules-based. But I think there's also bigger issues, like a lot of the models now are using synthetic data because they're running out of data. And so—
Oh yeah, I was involved with that.
And then you have like bigger models that are training smaller models. So all of a sudden you have this whole thing where there's a question around model collapse, where it's just sort of everything feeding everything into each other. And the outputs and the reinforcement learning is coming from other synthetic data. I really think there might be an industry in the future where all it is just people producing people data for the models to train on. So, but in terms of the feedback loop, yeah, I think that if you are able to give the feedback to the model in a consistent way and the model is localized, that will work better. But I think what also a lot of companies is missing is having a real understanding of what is an intelligence model, because there are things that AI is really good at and there are things that humans are really good at. And so being able to know where you should think about how to augment human and AI hybrid is something most companies have not figured out. So we know, for example, that AI is really good at recording and analyzing data, right? It's really good at gathering tons of information. It saves you so much time, and it's good at analyzing it. We also know that humans are better at what's called slicing and explanation. So humans are better at prioritizing, deciding what's important, and then being able to explain cause and effect. Like we're better at it, at least until today, up until now.
That's until now, right? Improving.
It is improving. So there is an intelligence model that we can start to follow and say what tasks go where. A lot of the issues also, even with the frontier models that I pick up, which is harder and harder for people to observe, is that the initial stage of just even getting the right data and pulling the right information from it continues to be a challenge. So that's gotten better over time, but it was significantly worse than what you would have imagined when you hear about like these models passing the humanities last exam and there's no more tests we can give it. It can create, you know, computer games in one prompt. And then I feed it a file and it still makes up a citation because they can't find the file, right? But it won't tell you that it can't find the file because these models don't know how to say, I don't know, or that I'm wrong, because in their training data, as people ask it for more answers, it's prompted to give answers, right? This isn't like an intern or like a person who understands the limit of their own cognitive thinking and experience and will say, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Or like, I think this is true, but I'm not sure. Models don't operate that way. And so again, without a mental model that we can really understand, I think sometimes people are surprised that it doesn't do, like, it's so confident in what a service is up. And you dig a little deeper, you're like, you just made up this whole study that never existed. And we see this happen, and this will continue to happen because you can never reduce hallucinations down to 0%.
Let's move a little bit to the people side of AI, which is an important topic that it's impacting everybody. Consumers who are using AI, employees who are being impacted by AI, et cetera, and adaptation is a big deal here. You said your standard is that people become more competent and confident working with you. How do you operationalize that?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a leadership perspective, that's sort of my North Star, right? So part of it has a lot to do with non-AI core concepts, like pushing accountability to the lowest level, making sure that you're dealing with toxic high performers in the right way, making sure you are walking the walk of celebrating, you know, learnings and failures, and being very, very self-aware and being humble about what you bring to the table. So those are all my sort of core leadership concepts. In terms of change management, which is anytime we have this technology, it's all around change management. It's both a tech problem and it's a people problem. So one of the things that there's a theory around, what does it mean to have AI in your company be adopted? And it's called, it's by Ethan Mollick, it's called the crowd, the lab, and the leadership. So I had not known about this, but we implemented a version of this at Credibly. So when I first started working on generative AI, all I did was get a group of people in the company together. I did a training for them. Based on my own course, I did a generative AI training. I just actually finished 3 modules on agentic commerce and human AI collaboration and frontier models. Same group of managers where I literally record a video and I bring them into 1-hour sessions. I have them go to websites, do demos, and like learn to work with tools. And all of that is just drum up enthusiasm and lack of fear. And yes, there's going to be different levels of adoption and speed. That's one of the parts of managing the complexity around working with generative AI and having different clock speeds from different departments. Then, so that's the crowd, right? People who are creating their own tools and experimenting and developing gems in Gemini and doing the Google Notebook. And we have a lot of examples of that. We have over 100 use cases now in the company where employees themselves are just coming up with things to make their own work more efficient. Then we're like, oh, we should probably have a policy. So we created some policies in the handbook that told people what they could and couldn't do. Then we also have the lab, and the lab is the Skunkworks team. Those are the people that did enterprise level solutions. And these are all now prompts that, you know, people who are more sophisticated, they're in a central place where people can go and look and modify and edit, play across different models. They have access to different frontier models. We give them the subscription to do that. They have to develop APIs because now it's not in the chat room anymore, right? You're truly interfacing with the model at scale. So we did that. That's part of our work stream. That's how we got our 2 patents on Gen AI. That's all the agentic stuff that now I'm working through, building agents. Then the third part is the strategy. And that was the last part because we got to a point where I was like, we should probably have a top-down vision of what we want the company to be. So I took the entire executive team on essentially a couple of workshops where we use scenario planning tools to imagine the future with AI, what our teams are going to look like, what are the titles and roles of these teams in this new world? What are the competencies that these people have to have? And then are we creating projects and moonshots to help them develop these competencies? I run marketing, right? So what does a brand manager role look like in the future? What does an underwriter's role look like in operations? It quickly became very clear, for example, that in the future world, a lot of the managerial duties has to do with defining objectives and defining risk. And using their experience to understand and guide AI to know what's good output and what's not good output. And that's one of those things where, okay, now people are like, great, like, how do I maintain those skill sets? Well, we're going to have continuous training where you're working to figure out how to underwrite certain kinds of deals. You can't just give it all to AI. You have to keep that competency up because you have to keep guiding these models to where you need them to go. We think that the QA function is going to grow because now you're QAing much more output because you have AI that can do more work now, but certain parts of the company has to grow. So monitoring frameworks, models, data science, like all these things are starting to become more important. So having that top-down strategy, I think in terms of a leadership philosophy is you have to have different ways to bring people along, but it absolutely starts with training and getting people excited and at a minimum, not afraid of the tools. And then we'll work from there, right? And it's also an imperfect process. I have to do a refresh again this quarter because it's been 6 months and now things are different. And so these are the kind of things that when you're dealing with system level change, and I am not saying I have it all figured out or I do it well. That's part of the humility in being like, as part of change management, no one here is an expert. No one knows how to navigate this. But if you think more deeply about this than your competitors, then your chances of running are better. And working with AI in a real way requires deep thinking in a way that I don't think people recognize because it's ethical. You have societal issues you're dealing with and you have something that touches on like what it means to be human, right? And so, yes, this is business and we're here to make money, but we also have to think through what does this mean for the future of our entire industry and also for the employees and also for the leadership team. So those are real questions that you can't get out of putting a prompt into ChatGPT.
Interesting, MJ, because you mentioned earlier, you know, you got to do a refresher, you're learning, you're studying. At the same time, your team is studying and learning and adapting, et cetera. So when everybody's learning, because it's very interesting time, because no, as you mentioned earlier, nobody's an expert. From a leadership perspective, that takes a lot of maneuverability, I guess, to bring yourself into a position where we're all learning at this, you know, at the same, hopefully absorbing all that information at the same pace. Maybe some people are not absorbing at the same rate as others, but we're all trying, we're all learning. But from a leadership perspective, everybody's learning, including yourself. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's super different from anything else, right? I've never approached leadership. I've done enough career changes and have seen people in
top. No, the reason I asked the question, because there are a lot of positions out there where, you know, you would hire a manager who's an expert at something, right?
Yes.
The head mechanic of the shop, he better know something about being a mechanic.
Yeah, but I will say that, like, I think my point that is, like, I've never really relied on, because of my background, I've never really thought that leadership by expertise is sort of the mantle of leadership. I think it can only go so far, right? I think that we also have plenty of examples of people who are experts being promoted to management roles and are terrible at it because they're simply just better as individual contributors. And so from my perspective, yes, we all have to learn. We all have to learn it together. Usually the executive team at companies is actually the worst at using generative AI because they push and delegate all of that down. So being able to actually do some of it, I think is important. It's the middle manager level. I think that's the most difficult because they still have to manage the core business and they have to drive the innovation. So your job as a leader is to figure out how to free up enough time and incentivize them to actually take on these additional tasks. And then ultimately, I think the leadership role here, which people can make a difference in when you're not a technologist or an expert, or you're just on your way to learning, is the people issues, right? Because leaders, when they have ascended and worked really long time in industries and they're good leaders, they have experience dealing with people. And that's really where all of the friction comes from, is when you have people and technology that have to move at the same pace. I have not found the people problems that I have been dealing with for 20 years now to be different with generative AI. It is all the same principles around change management. The clock speed is faster. You have more fear. You have more aversion. But change management, if you're good at change management, which no one is, but if you're good at change management, you're going to be better at AI. If you're not good at change management, it doesn't matter how enthusiastic you are about the technology, you're just not going to be good at adopting it. So those core principles don't change for me.
Don't change, yeah. Now, how big is Credibly?
Credibly is about 200 people.
And are you, like, in, you know, obviously you have a lot of skilled workers there and a lot of skilled employees. Are you able to find the skills? Are you local? Are you hiring global? How does that work for you?
We have some offshore teams and our skills are across the board, right? So we have people that are pure data entry. We have people that are more experienced underwriters. We have people that are senior underwriters. We have similar. We have marketing teams. We have sales teams. We have tech. We have data science. And my experience has been, so when I created my first group of generative AI champions, that they came from all over the company, okay? And for the most part, I wouldn't say this is a 100% one-to-one match. I would say it's probably an 85% match though. The people who are in that group with me, who are interested in devoting weekly time to work on projects, build agents, things like that, are also the higher performer members even without AI in the company. Why? Because they have these basic traits that make them high potential. They're tenacious, they're curious, they are willing to put in the work, and they want to learn. Right. And they want to invest in this thing. And I've seen my head of product at 10 o'clock at night on Saturday on Discord, just like building his own thing because he's interested in it. Right. I have sales reps who are building voice agents for the sake of just learning how to build with it. So people who are naturally already curious and tenacious learners, AI will give them superpowers and help them go as far as they can. It's the other end, right? It's the people who are not really super excited about learning, are not that curious, don't really want to improve, and are using it mostly to cognitively offload without replacing it with something of equal value. That's more of I call it sort of the darker side of the age of AI.
In your opinion, MJ, where do most Gen AI initiatives break down? Is it at strategy, tooling, people, incentives? What do you think it breaks down?
I think it breaks down a lot of areas. There's many ways. One of the things is the level of control that's being exerted. As we talked about, a lot of larger companies, some of my peers who I've had the privilege of sharing, you know, some classrooms with, have talked about how they're only authorized to use Copilot. And so they're not allowed to do anything else because there's a fear of like data and privacy and all these things, which I'm not saying that fear is wrong, But when you're not allowed to use the latest models, you're just not going to be able to learn as much, right? So that's one, the element of control where it's very centralized versus figuring out how to decentralize it, let people experiment, let people fail, let people make a few mistakes, think through the risks that's actually involved, while not just like, let's all reduce risk all the way down to zero, but actually think about what level of risk you're willing to tolerate. So that's one big area of where it fails. The second area is measuring ROI, because generative AI has been around. There's a lot of, I think, confusing information out there about the returns. So obviously, anytime you want to put a new thing in, it's got to go, like, you got to have like a business proposal. You've got to see returns. What are the costs? What's the cost benefit analysis? I'm not sure that's the right way to think about it in some ways, right? I think that's one element, but generative AI has inherent challenges because it is so disruptive and new. One is that a lot of times people who are saying I have increased in productivity or I've seen these increases are not measuring it the right way. When you look at the actual data, there's been studies that have said, if you actually take into account the amount of time people spend writing the prompt, editing the prompt, waiting for the model to return, reviewing the answer, copy and paste it into a thing, right? Like that actually takes more or equal time than you just doing it yourself. It just feels like a shorter time, but if you actually count the time, it may not be super beneficial. So there's a lot of studies around it. The other thing is this idea of measuring ROI without measuring things that are equally important that are qualitative. So one of the things that we were talking about is the rate of change, right? The rate of change and the level of disruption, how much you can disrupt your own work and how you do new ways of working. There's no real way to quantify that, but that is something that I look to as a way to measure AI. If I'm able to do things like, sure, this is going to cost me more in the short run because I have to pay OpenAI. However, if I'm able to work fundamentally differently and be able to do things that I wasn't able to do before, isn't that better for the business? And also, you should expect a failure rate of 75 to 80% on the experiments. Not all experiments are going to pay off. And so this very scrutinizing of like financial metrics, I think is also where it breaks down. And the third part it breaks down, we've already talked about, is when you haven't addressed concerns and you're meeting with the resistance, but it's sort of undertone and no one's really telling you the truth and people are actively working against you because they think they're going to lose their jobs. That's where also it breaks down. There's the people side that breaks down. There's the financial and the ROI side that breaks down. And then there's the centralized control that also causes the breakdown.
And the other thing too is that you alluded to earlier is the balance. You know, most of these companies are not just working on AI. They still have customers to serve. They still have the day-to-day operation to run. And in most cases, and I don't know how it works for you for Credibly, but most companies that I've been in touch with, they seem to have, you know, they take somebody from marketing or they take somebody from product, they take somebody from customer service for that matter, from their what they do day to day. And they say, okay, you got to focus on AI. You got to do something with AI. And I don't know how that works because if it wasn't, you know, if they weren't busy 100% of the time, first, we don't need them. The second thing is if they're busy 100% of the time, you give them another project. Now you are asking them to be busy more than 100% of the time. So one of the things that always comes up is, you know, how do you prevent AI from becoming a side project, MJ, instead of a core capability? A lot of people are struggling with that. A lot of multi-medium businesses are there already. It's not like they have, you know, an unlimited amount of money for budget to say, I'm going to focus on AI now, and I'm going to let the other side of the business go to whatever.
Yeah, and I think that's always been part of the challenges with innovation, right? Which is like, how do you find the time to innovate? That's why large tech companies have hackathons and they have, you know, offsite.
I love that.
Work and all that. So part of the things that we've done here is when I first implemented the group of Gen AI champions, and I told people here, you're going to have to work and have to put in extra time. We have an employee budget that we use for employee and skill enhancement. And so part of it is like, hey, we'll give you a few hundred dollars to take this class or to spend some time now to free up some element of your work that you can automate using generative AI. But when you are able to free up, and I told my marketing team, I expect you to free up 4 hours, 1/10 of the time that you're supposedly working. Everybody works more than 40 hours, but like, assume you work 40 hours. I want you to free up 4 hours every week. I'm going to pay you a bonus right now to figure that out. But instead of backfilling those 4 hours with more work, take those 4 hours and learn. And that's kind of like a way you can get through that initial hump where you're displacing something, but then you're replacing it with learning. And so that's one way to handle it. I think another way to handle it is just understanding that like you have to have different levels in the company. And so the experimentation can happen ad hoc at a very small level, but businesses that are serious will have to eventually, when people are trained and feel comfortable, make Gen AI driven products or processes or deliverables part of their corporate objectives, part of their objectives, right? And say like, okay, we're now going to do these things, but we want to use it as a tool. What are the ways that we have to do to get there? I never recommend forcing Gen AI top down on day one. I do think that there is a time though, once you've done the training, once you've given people some time to experiment and you've given them the appropriate incentives to place, now you can say, we're going to go on this journey. And we have said, we're going to go on this journey. And there's a point where you have to say you're in or you're out, right? That's just a reality of business. I've talked to a lot of professors about.
You're on the train or you're off the train.
And some of them have these very, and they asked me, you know, I walked them through this PowerPoint I put together and I was like, I'm like, this is never going to show up in any of your research papers, but I'm telling you, you also have to fire some people because that is the reality of what businesses have to do when they have to go through change management. Because realistically, you just cannot bring 100% of the people along and it is foolish to think so. Otherwise, you're always catering to the lowest common denominator who's going to hold everybody back. And like, that's a reality, right? You're not going to see that in the study, but that's 100% true. Like you're going to have to fire the laggards and people who are going to do everything they can to stop, you know, to stop progress because they don't want to be part of it or they don't believe in it. I'm going to do everything to mitigate that. I don't want fear or lack of knowledge to be the reason why this has to happen. But after a certain point, I have done enough change management enough to know there are people who are just going to say no matter what you do, and that they got to go.
So speaking of letting go, have you had to let it go not the ABCs, not the Cs, but a strong performer because they couldn't adapt? And how did you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I have had it, and not in the age of AI, but I have seen other leaders who've had to do that, who are they're very strong technically, but they're very averse to automation. They're very averse to tech projects. And so we have had experts who are very good on the risk assessment side. However, whenever we wanted to roll out tech initiatives, they hold back so much progress. The level of complaining and sort of bad behaviors that then suppress the rest of their team and inject like a negative feeling around these initiatives. There was plenty of opportunities, and eventually that person was let go. On the side that I run, which is sales, pre-AI, we have people that I'm a very big believer in looking out for toxic high performers, right? These people do really well for the company. You know, they generate joy to the team. They're very bad with morale. They do it for themselves. It's at the expense of everything else, but because of their output, they think the company will never touch them. And I don't believe in that. And I will tell you, you know, we talk about these like $1 million salespeople who do so much for the company. And we used to have one. And ever since that person's been gone, we have three, because you don't know what they're actually holding back. And they hold other people back through their negativity. They hold them back through their attitude and their lack of respect and their unwillingness to help other people, right? Like the morale affects everyone. And so those are some of the best things and toughest decisions a leader can make, is knowing who and when to back the right people. And it's not always the top performers.
Absolutely. Now, what did this role teach you about yourself as a leader, MJ?
Chief Strategy Officer. So I was given the role because I started with a Chief Marketing Officer, and I was given the role of Chief Strategy Officer because I was stepping on too many people's toes. And so part of it was just like recognizing and being very comfortable to tell the leadership. I run the leadership development here, and I also work with executives on reflection exercises. But one of the things that I really appreciate is building a culture of high performance where healthy conflict and stepping on each other's toes is the norm, because you actually make each other better, right? Which is very hard for people because the initial is like defend and be like, this is my territory, this is my expertise. I don't know why you're in my space all of a sudden. Why are you moving my cheese? But if you can actually create that culture, I think it goes a long way. So that is one thing that I've learned in this role, which is like, it's not so much about strategy. I will tell you that in this company, I am not the best at strategy. There's plenty of people who are better at strategy, and their work is actually what's being shown, and they present the work, right? Our head of product is really good at product strategy. We have super smart people in the company. So I am not the one responsible for the corporate strategy. But I am the one that helps lubricate and keep things moving, because I really try to create the culture and communication where people are comfortable inserting themselves into other people's stuff when they feel like it's right for the business. So that's I think, like, having a thick skin really helps. And the other thing I kind of tell people, I've grown less fearful over time. And I think part of it is credit to Credibly. Just being in an environment where I'm not spending a ton of time trying to figure out, like, did this person say what they intended to say? And are they saying other things behind my back when I leave this room? I don't have time for that. Like, I so do not want to waste time thinking about, like, did I politically do the right thing here? Like, it's too much of my brain power. And frankly, like, you want my brain on other things. And I told the leadership that. I'm like, you want me thinking about business problems. You do not want me thinking about, like, what should I wear tomorrow? Like, it's like, I don't care about that. So again, I think being able to identify where time is being wasted and saying, like, we're not doing this anymore because this is wasting people's precious time. That's really helpful in incubating Gen AI as well. Because anytime you're trying to adopt new technology, you have to identify waste, right? And you don't punish people for failure, but you do punish them for waste. And that's a very different way of thinking about approach, failure.
Yeah. Now, speaking of that, for those who are listening, owners, operators, CEOs, et cetera, of other companies, what advice would you give them about, they're just about to step into AI-driven transformation? What kind of advice you would want them to hear or be aware of, I should say?
Yeah. I would say, first of all, do not delegate out change management. Do not hire a chief AI officer. Those don't exist. Like, I'm sorry, they just don't. You have to be in these models playing a little bit with them, so you have a sense of what's capable and what doesn't work, right? Usually what happens with CEOs and operators is they swing too far one way or the other, right? They go way too whole into the whole, like, AI is going to change everything and we should fire everybody because it's going to do 100% of jobs. Or they're like, this thing is terrifying. It's never going to work in the career. No, your job is to assess risk because you're the one who knows how to do that and the buck stops with you. So find the best way to assess risk and learn enough just so you're able to do that. That's like the number one thing, is thinking about that. And the other thing is what I've suggested is, like, watch out for the areas where there's problems, right? There's change management. There is, are you measuring it the right way? Are you measuring it beyond just cost benefit in terms of finances? Because there's other ways, to qualitative ways to measure rate of change, take rate in the company, employee feedback and enthusiasm. Those things are important. And the last thing is making sure that you understand, like, the learner's approach. You have to understand that, like, it's complex and you will have different clock speeds in the company that you would have to control. So not everything has to move or can move at the same speed. If you can just have a few things, not a transformative project, but like a couple of experiments, maybe one big project, and doing it and learning and iterating with it, then you will go a lot further than people who spend a lot of time in PowerPoints and spend a lot of time controlling it. So those are my, like, sort of very practical advice. Play with it yourself, figure out what metrics you actually care about and are looking at, and making sure that you have a few projects going on that you can ship quickly versus waiting on something super transformative or controlling it so tightly that nothing innovative actually gets done.
Cognizant of the time, MJ, if people remember one thing out of this conversation between you and I today, which I've truly enjoyed, and I wish that this conversation would go for two more hours. I love talking about that stuff. What should that key points you want them to remember?
Yeah, this is actually a question that I've been thinking about very deeply recently myself, and I don't have a good answer for, but I encourage everyone to think about it, which is, a lot of times when you read and think about AI, the common mantra you hear is it's how you use it, right? It's the how that matters. I don't think it's that simple. I mean, yeah, and to some extent it is how, but who decides the how? So my question for everybody is, whether you're a leader, you're a parent, you're an individual, it doesn't matter. You as an individual have to decide how you're going to use it in a way that makes you better and not just makes the AI better. And if you can figure that out, and I outlined a LinkedIn post that gave people some questions to kind of think through, but that's my biggest thing is, like, are you using it in a way that makes you better, or are you using it in a way that simply makes it better? If you can figure out ways to make you better, then your future is boundless, because this thing does give you superpowers. But if you're using it in a way that's all you're doing is making it better and making you lazier, I think you're taking a shortcut now at the expense of things that are really important long-term, that drive meaning in our lives and you won't know how to get those.
You know, for the audience, I'm really enjoying this conversation. I've learned a lot from MJ today. I hope you did too. There was a lot of good nuggets here from this conversation. I hope it applies in your business, in your life. And also, I want to mention that AI will continue accelerating. Leadership quality is sometimes the real bottleneck in some companies. I've seen that. The companies that win are the ones that build people as fast as they build systems. People build systems. You got to remember that. And for the audience as well, on behalf of the audience and myself, MJ, I want to thank you for being part of this conversation.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I hope the audience will interact positively with this conversation down the road as we publish. And if you have any comments or questions to MJ directly, we are connected on LinkedIn. Please feel free to reach out to MJ directly or call me or email me or connect with me on LinkedIn and I'll facilitate an introduction. I really appreciate your time, your listening in and liking and sharing this content with your network. Thanks so much, everybody. MJ, hang on one second.